Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's August 20th, 2017, and welcome to episode 157 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know.
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia and collecting, and getting things done, or not. My name is Jack Nutting, and I am joined today by two regulars of the roundtable, Mr. Paul Hagstrom. How's it going, Paul?
Yeah, it's going pretty well. Summer is racing to a close, but otherwise, yeah, no, things are relatively good in the retro computing sphere.
Are you in Boston right now?
I am indeed.
I heard some things happened in Boston yesterday.
Yeah, lots of people walking around.
Did you walk around or did you stay inside?
I stayed away.
Good.
But yes.
Good.
Pictures were impressive.
Yeah, good pictures. Earl Evans is also with us. How are you doing today, Earl?
I'm here. I'm with you. I'm all of the above. I'm doing okay. I hurt my back a little bit about a week ago. I went bouldering with my son. Indoor bouldering. You guys ever heard of that?
No.
Is that like bowling but with big rocks?
Yeah. Well, they have these big artificial boulders with handholds, and not handhelds, that's a whole different thing. And at varying angles and intensities so that you can pretend that you're climbing real boulders. And but I accidentally zigged when I should have zagged. I hurt my back a little bit. And then the 1980s called and reminded me that I'm not there anymore. So I should be a little bit more careful with my body. But it is a lot of fun, though. And cool. I didn't die. Which you could do, you know, if you're out climbing a real boulder. So,
right.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's
how good is this
news.
Different from other kinds of like artificial rock and wall climbing?
Well, say for instance that you go rock wall climbing and they have the harness on you to belay. You have somebody doing the belay while you're doing the climbing,
right.
And if you slip, then you don't come tumbling down. But here, in this bouldering that I was doing, no such thing. You're just free climbing. And the floor is heavily padded. So if you fall onto it, you don't, break something. But how else would it be different? Another way I think it's different with this particular gym is that these artificial boulders have a lot of drill holes, and they can set the hand and foot holds into various configurations. So on every 2-week basis, I think, or something like that, they come in and they reset everything so that it doesn't get boring. Like if you come back a couple weeks later, you're doing a different climb.
Nice. You have a different experience each time you go.
Yeah.
Replayability.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, cool. Well, let's get on to it. I don't have any news about my part of the world. Sweden is just boring, boring, boring. Boring weather, everything boring. No, but yeah.
How far north are you? Is the summer largely light, or are you south enough that it's fairly normal?
Yeah, I'm south enough. I'm in Stockholm, and here it's bright out until say, I don't know, 8:30 or 9, maybe something like that. But it's, as we're recording it now, it's 10:30 p.m. and it is dark as night. Ah, so
okay.
Yeah, at this point, right now, Sweden is indistinguishable from, I don't know, Minnesota. Excellent. You know, not hot, not cold, just a place.
Boring, 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 as Jack Nutting says.
That's right. That's my advanced opinion on it. All right. So let's get on to business here. Our host topic tonight is eBay. Why is it terrible? I mean, we all buy stuff on eBay, and there are certain recurring patterns of, I don't know what to call it, like patterns of behavior that you see in the people placing ads. Things like that people will have some item that they will just name the item and then toss in the word rare and set the price to $1,000 when you know it, you can get one for $50. Things like that. Things like the fact that some people write it's something that's not tested when something would be so easy to test, and you don't know, are they just lazy, or is it because, are they saying it's not tested because they know it actually does not work? I don't know. What are your guys' pet peeves about eBay? Paul, what are you thinking?
Oh, I have. How long do you have?
I want to time box this.
Right.
Okay. No more than 1 minute per peeve.
Excellent. Except for, yes, specific peeves about pets, right? But one sort of category of people who are selling things are the people who really don't know anything about what they've got, and you know they found it in an attic, or they found it at, you know, a garage sale down the street or something like that. And there's a certain extent to which these are actually rare in some sense. Like, you know, there are many fewer of these than there are iPhones, right?
Right.
Whatever they are. So it does seem like there are sort of two different groups of people. Like they're the collectors for whom, you know, an Atari 800 is not rare. You can find them all over the place if you're in that community. But people who don't see them all the time think they are rare. So I can sort of forgive that kind of a thing. Although there's clearly kind of a mercenary aspect to this, where someone thinks, all right, I've hit pay dirt here.
Right.
I've got a rare thing, and I'm going to try to make money off the fools. One thing actually too that I've come across a couple times on eBay is that I don't list things very often, so my knowledge may not be super up to date, but it's fairly clear that when you list things, eBay will sometimes suggest, like, here, I'll fill in the details for you from something that is similar, right? Some listing that someone else put in. And so I've seen things that are, you know, the pictures say it's, here's a thing for the Amiga, and it's filled, all the details are filled in, like, you know, here's an Apple II game. And it's just because there was and when I went to search, I could see pretty much the other listing that it was lifted from. And I think eBay enables that, like helps you by enabling that. And so it's not necessarily when you see that, it's not necessarily the case that someone has just lifted someone's listing and said, I'm going to try to pawn off my thing.
Right.
So, I mean, I guess, there probably are terrible people out there, but I do tend to try to spin things as much as possible in the favor of the ignorant rather than the malicious.
Right.
But
yeah, I guess the one time that I was interested in buying something that was marked as not tested, I actually emailed the person and said, okay, could you at least just plug in the power and turn it on and tell me if the light comes on? And he did. He said, yeah, that works. So I gambled and bought it, and the thing was fine. So, you know, he could have at least done that. I'm sure, I guess, if you have an old computer and all you have is a brand new television and don't know how to plug it in and get tried any kind of signal out of it, okay, fine. But, like, he could have at least said, power's on, right? He could have tested it that far. I don't know. I think there's a certain amount of laziness sometimes. And I think that also applies to, you know, we've talked about this before. We often see things where the photography is just inexcusably terrible in this day and age. Like, how can you take such a bad photograph of an item and put it up on the web? Just like, it's inconceivable.
Well, maybe they're using a vintage camera.
Ah,
yeah.
They're using that. What was that first Apple digital camera?
Oh, the QuickTake.
The yeah. QuickTake. Using the QuickTake.
Yeah, VGA quality.
Earl, what do you think? What are your what bugs you the most about eBay?
Oh my gosh! Well, I'm kind of like Paul. I do have a large and impressive list of things, but I'll keep it short. One thing that drives me nuts is memorabilia, because when I'm looking in the vintage computer section for either things I'm interested in or some listing to talk about on the podcast, I have to wade through just tons and tons of hats and buttons and pins and posters. And one of the things that drives me the most nuts about that is a lot of them are from the 90s and the 2000s, and they're not even anything that tends to be apropos for what we're talking about. I mean, the list of Apple posters on there is, those are probably the most numerous that I see. And, and in some cases, they're even more recent than the last decade. They're like things that you might have seen this decade or something. And I'm like, what is this doing in this category? But some of the memorabilia, even though it's applicable for this particular category, it's just, I got to ask you guys, does anybody buy that stuff? Why is it up there?
Yeah.
Good question.
I mean, I always sort of figured that there are people, I am not among them, for whom the difference between, $15 and $100 is really not relevant. And and if you're thinking, oh, it'd be kind of neat to get this poster or whatever, you just buy it. And my assumption is that that's who the target audience is for these kind of lists, listings, is, for people for whom money is no object, they'll sell it at the, the $400 price or whatever. It's true that there are some weird, I think there are a couple of sellers who really just bombard that category, particularly on Sundays, it seems like, when we're trying to find stuff. But, I don't know. Another thing I was going to say was that, like, to a 20-year-old, things that were around when they were 15 might seem vintage.
Right. That's true. That's fair enough. But they're not.
Right. They're wrong about this, but nevertheless.
The other thing that drives me nuts is the amount of total junk that's out there. I wonder how many more 4X and 8X CD-ROM readers we need listed on the vintage computer section of eBay. Because today I probably counted 50 as I was going through just trying to find some listing that somebody really would want to buy. I guess the good news is if you're in the market for an old 8X IDE CD-ROM reader, you're in luck because eBay's got you covered. I guess the last thing I talk about is books. This isn't really a pet peeve. This is more like just a caution. And we've talked about it before on the show that if somebody is interested in a particular book, you see it on eBay, don't just click buy it now. Go check the used booksellers on the internet, like Amazon or Abbey Books, or there's a couple of others that are out there, and see if you can find it cheaper, because sometimes I've seen a book on eBay in this section for $20. I could go get it for $3 or $4 shipped from another bookseller. Now, sometimes that's not the case. One time I got a book, I don't remember exactly what the title is, something like Hidden Secrets of the TRS-80 Model 100, and the book's nearly unobtainium. It's like kind of like a programmer's reference guide for the Model 100. I saw it, and I snagged that thing immediately because I knew nobody out there had it, and if they did have it, they were charging big kahuna kind of bucks for it. But that's more the exception rather than the rule. Usually, you'll find it at a better price elsewhere, so just be careful.
Right.
How about you, Jack? You have any eBay complaints?
I don't know. I think my biggest complaint is just I don't know. I'd say it's more things. I get irritated by the user interface. That's a totally different issue, though. I think the actual content, since a lot of it, I just, you know, I kind of go back and forth between believing in the inherent goodness of all mankind and thinking that at least half of them are just dicks.
Yeah.
And so, like, so if I'm in the better mood, I can sort of say, okay, sure, someone's posted something really asinine on eBay for an incredible, ridiculous price. You know, I'm sure they had their reasons. I'm sure they're fighting their own demons. They've got their own problems to worry about. And if I'm being generous, otherwise I think, oh man, what the hell is this? You know, but I don't know. I guess I tend to not be that bothered by the dumb things that people do. I try not to be. I try to find something, try to look at something else that bothers me. But yeah, I don't know. I guess this is probably actually why I don't even buy that much stuff off of eBay. Because, like, in general, I guess my general pet peeve is that I have a hard time finding anything that I actually want. And often when I do, it's something that a lot of other people seem to want also, and the price goes way up, and it's just like, at some point, just like, nope, too rich for my blood. Mm-hmm. So
there is actually one thing that I was just reminded of, which is that there's this like recurring discussion that always happens where someone, often it's somebody who doesn't know what they have, you know, they saw something that's kind of like it sell for a whole lot of money before, and so they list their own actually common version of it for a lot, or maybe that's just something that is actually rare but they had an extra digit or something like that, you know, so here you can buy this, you know, whatever, Atari 800 for $1,000 or something. But and so there's this reaction which I probably shouldn't be bothered by, but it just seems so cyclical that on, you know, whatever retro computing forum, someone will post the link and say, oh, this guy's, what is this guy on? You know, like some variation of, I would like to smoke what they're smoking, or, you know, whatever. Right. And then there's this followed up by a comment saying, oh, I should sell, you know, my four of them. I would be a gazillionaire. And then people, you know, ranting about how dumb they are and all this stuff. And it sort of seems like, you know, all right, I don't understand is really what the point of these little cycles are, because yeah, there is probably some reason that the person listed it. My hypothesis sometimes is that some family member has said, you've got to get rid of this, list this on eBay. So they list it for $15,000 and nobody buys it, and so they have to keep it.
I think you've told us something about yourself here.
Yeah, I see.
But this projection. I like your theory. It's very interesting.
Anyway, whatever.
Yeah. All right. Good. Okay. Well, we'll get back to more eBay stuff later. But it's first time to get on to some listener feedback. We just, a couple hours ago, I think, got an email from Ricky, who's interested in collecting palm tops. Writes about getting an NEC Mobile Pro 750C and wondered if anyone else is interested in this otherwise, and he provided a link to his blog for ongoing discussion. So if anyone else is interested in these kind of palm tops and can't find fellow interested people, well, here's one. RickyEvans.blogspot.com. And
I should say that the appeal of collecting such things for me now is that they're small. I don't have any space for anything bigger, so
yeah.
It's true, I don't have a palm top collection. I have a couple of the palm tops that I just kind of collected organically because I owned them and I never got rid of them. One was one of the old 1-inch thick compact iPacks that really has a nice color display and actually runs, believe it or not, off of a small camcorder battery, and has one of the early versions of Windows CE, and it's a nice unit. The other one that I have is a handspring visor, which used the Palm OS, and this is a monochrome driven by, I think, two or three AAA batteries, and they're very interesting devices. And I like what you were saying, Paul, that they're small. The other thing that I have in my collection, actually, a lot of these I got from a donation from one of the Retrobits listeners many years ago. A number of what would you even call them? The handheld basic programmable computer slash calculators. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They have the wide display, like a 40 column display, and they have the calculator keyboard and varying amounts of RAM. And often they run off of a couple of watch batteries. And I think that they're really neat. And, you know, the companies like Sharp, Tandy, even made docking stations for them. They had a little connector on the side, so you could pop them in the docking station. You got a little thermal printer and maybe a cassette interface so you can save your programs. And the neat thing is that that entire collection fits inside one of my Rubbermaid bins, as opposed to the rest of my collection. So, yeah, I could see where palm tops would be. And, you know, the other thing, palm tops age in dog years, right? Because computers from the year 2000 are probably not something we'd be terribly interested in, but palm top computers or PDAs from the year 2000 would be stone tablet ancient at this point. Mm-hmm. So,
right.
Yeah, cool kind of thing.
Yep, yeah, I agree. The size is really nice. I have a few things. I have one or maybe two handspring visors, and I've got one or two other palm devices. And actually, the handspring visor is great because it runs on just normal AA or AAA batteries. I was going through my stuff. I came across one a month or two ago when I was cleaning up my stuff, and I was like, hey, I wonder if it still works. Popped in new batteries, and there it is, as good as new. Huh. I was missing some of the stuff he used to have for it, but I'll find it somewhere. But yeah, it's nice that like it's so small that it's never a concern of, oh, I've got this big honking thing taking up half my desktop. It's just a thing you tuck away in a box somewhere. But yeah, it was good though. I liked it a lot. I had a lot of fun with that when it was new. And it's cool that you can just sort of, you don't have to worry about changing out some funky old battery, because I also know that I have somewhere a Palm Tungsten T, which I know has a built-in battery.
Ouch.
And I'm sure whenever I find that, you know, that's been sitting around for 10, 15 years untouched, probably it's going to be difficult.
You know, I actually just managed to buy maybe two months ago or something, new batteries for my, I figured I would come up with a number by the time I got to that point in the sentence and have forgotten. But my, anyway, it's a Palm device. It was a phone. Anyway, 650, I think, was the number, but I forget the designation. But anyway, it had a special battery, and I was, it was failing because it was super old. And, but it turned out that you can still buy them. So
okay.
I bought a couple new ones. Trio. That's it. Trio 650.
Mm-hmm. Oh, right. Yep.
I know you program mobile devices these days, Jack. Did you back in the day, did you ever take a crack at anything like, MetroWorks Code Warrior or, any of those tools for programming the Palm OS?
I did a little bit just for fun. I didn't ever use MetroWorks. I did some stuff using, what was it? I think it was basically some open source tools that someone had rolled together. So you used some form of GCC as a cross compiler to build a Palm executable,
mm-hmm.
And that was pretty fun. I also remember that there was an onboard C for the Palm OS, which was pretty crazy. You would write C code on the Palm, and it would compile it on there. And like, it was not the best optimizing compiler, certainly, because it was running on, you know, on a limited device with limited battery time and that sort of thing. So, like, you couldn't make a really advanced application and have it, it was kind of like the difference between running something in debug mode versus something that's actually properly optimized. But it worked. It worked just fine. And it was pretty cool. Yeah, there was actually all kinds of weird stuff. There was a good fourth compiler on the Palm called Cortis, which I had a lot of fun with. back in the day also. And that was also the thing where you would do your fourth coating on the palm. And I've been living with a very long commute for a very long time. And this is, you know, back before there was a lot of good internet always during my commute. So this sort of having access to this 15 years ago was actually pretty great. I could sit in the bus for half an hour each morning, each afternoon, and, you know, mess around with something interesting.
That is so cool. I wonder if those things are still out there now. I wonder if they would be possible to dig up. And I wonder if they would even work on the modern operating systems, or we'd have to go back to Windows 2000 or something. But cool.
Yeah, I don't really know. But yeah, there's probably a way.
On-device programming on one of the palms. I did not see that coming.
Yep. That was the thing to do for me, as far as I was concerned. That seemed like an obvious thing to do. Probably not the typical user scenario, but that's what I did. All right, should we move along here? We got some more listener feedback from Phil, has written us, I think, more than once about the arcade experience at the Center of Computing History in Cambridge, which is coming up quite soon on the 2nd of September. They have a whole bunch of stand-up arcade games that are confirmed to be there. A lot of standards like Centipede, Tempest, Mr. Do, some fun things like Pac-Mania, Popeye. I used to love Popeye. Good old Popeye. Some pinball games, some other things, like they had a maybe Return of the Jedi. I hope it's the one you sit down in instead of just the one you stand up in. I love those sit-down Star Wars games. So if you're anywhere in or around Cambridge, September 2nd, you should go check it out.
I forget if I mentioned this on the last podcast, but just coming back from Kansas Fest at that point, I played Asteroids in Kansas City, and I was very impressed by the... I was super impressed by it in a way that I wasn't anticipating. So playing a real Asteroids game is worth doing.
Yep, that is. I haven't played one else. I played one many, many years ago. I mean, when that was new, I guess. But probably have not played one since the 80s.
Yeah, it was. There's something that really struck me about the varying brightness that they have. Like your shots, shots against the asteroids are a higher brightness than the actual other stuff that's going around. So it gives it a kind of a depth. I don't know.
Right. Tony sent an email asking us about the podcast workflow. And this is interesting because I know that, Paul, you had posted a picture of a screenshot of something recently. And Kevin Savitz replied, "Wow, that looks very different from how I do my podcast recordings."
Yeah. I don't know how much time we want to spend on this, but what I've been using to do the podcast editing is this program. It's a Adobe program called Audition. Is that right? Mm-hmm. I lose track.
Don't ask me.
and I have it. It's part of the the big creative suite that includes Photoshop and that kind of stuff. And I have it anyway, basically through work. It's just kind of an expensive program otherwise.
Right.
I find it pretty nice for taking care of like background noise, like editing out noise. But and there's a free thing that a lot of people use called Audacity, which does okay, but actually has pretty good noise reduction, but doesn't. The thing I like about Audition is it's all sort of live, so I can kind of see, I can see the things happening. I can see the spectrograms and stuff of the audio.
Right. And it looked like from the screenshot, it looked like you were able to deal with many, many tracks all at once in a way that if you can do that with Audacity, I don't know it. Maybe you can. I've used Audacity just a bit to sort of mess with a single file, but I haven't really figured out how to sort of combine a lot of stuff into one big project.
Yeah, you can do the multi track pretty well in Audacity. It's just things are a lot more in batch mode. So you set some parameters and you say go, and then hope it was okay, and then revise and do it again. And so, I think the thing that's different between what like Kevin's philosophy and Carrington's also. Carrington did the editing, I think, on a lot of these before before I unwisely took over. But yeah, so each of us record our audio ourselves on our own track, And then I take the all those and combine them so that they, you know, I line them up so that they're in sync. Occasionally when we all talk at the same time, I try to spread it out a little bit, or if we just sit there saying nothing, staring blankly into the distance, then I cut that part out.
If? I think you mean when.
Right. But yeah, but I think Kevin's approach is basically just get the thing done and get it out, or else you will burn out. And I totally know what he means.
Yeah.
if you look at that screenshot that I had posted, it was, part of what was impressive looking about it is just that it's many, 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 many little slices of audio. Because I've gone through and I've sort of chopped out places where people aren't talking so that in case something falls over in their office or something, you don't hear it and that kind of stuff. But I mean, just generally what I do is I take the audio, I normalize it, run it through a noise reduction. I do a little bit of equalization to try to get, you know, reduce the harshness of the S's and bring up the bass a little bit and that kind of thing. And, and then line them up, and then try to, this is where I have to kind of like earball it a little bit, but I try to get everybody's level pretty similar and then send it out. So that's basically what I do.
Cool. It'd be fun to see more how that works. Like, I have an idea. You know, I've done a lot of audio editing of music and stuff, but never really this kind of thing where you have three or four different sources who all recorded something at the same time, and it will probably be generally lined up, but not 100% because technology.
It's better than if they were like actually rolling tape, though, with varying speeds. Yeah. Mostly the speeds are the same.
Right. Cool. Well, I, for one, am very glad that you do this, Paul. The result is very good, and it's good to have a nicely edited podcast.
Seconded.
And I'm not trying to throw stones at Kevin Savitz here. Kevin, your work is also brilliant.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah, no, I mean, like, there's no way that you could get as much output volume, I don't think, without a hired team as Kevin gets. I mean, like, you just have to get it out there. And they do sound fine.
Yeah, they sound great, and, like, it's, you know, there's no problem there. I noticed that I've heard some podcasts where someone has obviously done some fairly aggressive editing where a lot of the natural pauses in speech end up being shortened. And it can be somewhat unnerving. And it's like you listen, it's like, wow, are these people really talking that way? Are they really sort of just kind of rambling on without ever a pause to breathe? So it's, I don't know. I prefer it when things sound more like an actual conversation. Anyway, there's something to be said for not overworking something also.
Oh, yeah. There are some places, though. I mean, you know, a little private victories that I've had where I've managed to cut out, like, a whole bunch of stuff and bring together two pieces so that it seems like they went together.
Right.
No one will ever know. Nope. I should also say that there was some suggestion of, like, maybe we could have a blooper reel or whatever, but almost nothing ever gets cut out of this. I mean, like, the only kinds of things are, like, people coughing.
Yeah.
So it's not a very interesting blooper reel.
The cough reel.
Yeah.
All right. Okay, cool. Our final piece of listener feedback, Bob sent us something, a link to hackjunk.com, an interesting article about swapping out the CPU in a Commodore C16 or C++4. Apparently, it uses the 8501 CPU, which I'd never even heard of. And you can swap that out for a 6510, which is what the Commodore 64 also used, I believe. And it involves some work, and you'll apparently lose the port for running the cassette motor. But you'll get a more reliable CPU, apparently.
Well, certainly a more plentiful CPU, because there's a gabillion of the Commodore 64s and 64Cs, but not as many of the other models.
Okay. So is that part of it also that just that if in case there is a problem and you need to replace the CPU, it's just that much easier to find a 6510?
Yeah, might be a little easier to find a 6510.
Yeah.
It's actually pretty involved, this project, because it's not, there's some sort of pin remapping socket that that is placed on there. And you know, there's some signal that the 8501 uses to run the cassette that the 6510 doesn't have or something like this. But actually the kernel ROM was rewritten as well. So, in order to use the new chip. And I don't know exactly how that works. But it's not just a chip for chip replacement. It's actually a fairly involved project.
Right. Interesting.
And amazing that it works.
And if I can editorialize, amazing someone would spend that effort to revive a C16 or a C++4.
Right. Like, so you can run that built-in terrible program.
I don't understand. But that's okay. We don't have to understand all of our fellow nerds. We all have our own things we're focused on, and somebody loves those things.
Yep.
So that's good. All right. Moving along, two items of interest. Earl, you've got something cool.
Well, this is labeled a virtual museum of computing, and it's an augmented reality experience that will teach you some things about the history of computing. That's not actually, though, the thing that I'm the most interested about this. This is also a collection of Blender 3D models you can download for many, many vintage computer systems. That interests me quite a bit because there are workflows that will get you from Blender models into a variety of 3D environments, like for building 3D applications like Unity. And I think it would be fun to make your own little 3D world that had these vintage computers in it, maybe some vintage monitors, and maybe you even tie it back to an emulator so your virtual vintage computer actually works. You can do things with it. So that's what interested me about this, and I'm going to download some of these and light them up. But Blender can actually be a little bit of a beast of a program, unless you've got a fairly beefy computer. So I'm going to put this on my desktop and light it up and check out some of these models and just have some fun, see how they do.
Yeah, this looks very cool. I was thinking the exact same thing you were saying, of pulling these into something else. I'm sitting messing around with some games I'm working on in Unity just for fun, and I was thinking, hey, I could pop some retro computers in there.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Have a little TRS-80 falling on somebody's head or something.
Right. Okay. Lob IBM PCs at people or whatever.
That would be more damage.
Yeah. The models are incredible, though. I mean, like, I'm only seeing them in I haven't brought them up in Blender, so I don't know how detailed they are, but at this at the scale that they are on the website, it's just amazing. And they're sort of rare too. I mean, like, there's like Vector Graphic 1, AIM 65.
There's a Difference Engine.
Nice.
It makes me wonder too if some of the pieces could be articulated, like the keys on the keyboard, whether or not those would be independently movable, and if you could actually have some sort of a virtual keystroke.
That'd be cool.
That'd be cool.
In a VR world where you're 1/10 scale and you can smash on the keys to type basic.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I would love to see this in action. I'll have to try to play with that. Let's try to find some time.
I have to say, I'm a little bit disappointed there is not a single Atari computer or video game in this, which is kind of a surprising omission. You think there would be one?
It is. It's a bummer.
But, oh, well. All right. Anyway, yeah, cool. I think, you know, it would be fun if their little virtual museum was actually available online to look at in some way, instead of just being kind of a stand that is in some spot. But it's very cool that the models are there. I look forward to pulling these into something, playing with them a bit. Let's see. Next up is me. This is not a particularly new item, but it's new to me. This popped up on Quora, I think, a couple months ago. Alan Kay answered a question about what it was like at Xerox PARC when Steve Jobs visited. And he wrote a pretty interesting answer to this. It's not super long. It's a few minutes read. And this is kind of the famous instance where Steve Jobs and some other folks from Apple went to visit Xerox PARC, and that's where they got a lot of the inspiration to build the Mac, the Macintosh, the original Mac, and well, the Lisa for that matter also. A lot of the GUI ideas came from this visit. And what Alan Kay says is some interesting things, basically that he repeats the point that has come up before, that that of the three main points they wanted to show with the Alto, which was the GUI and the network and the operating environment and programming environment, the only one that Steve Jobs latched onto was the GUI. And so all of the interesting parts of like the network computing model and of using Smalltalk was all just kind of ignored. And he also mentioned that at the time of this visit, this was not entirely new, nor was it entirely unknown. He said that this version of the Alto that they were using at that time had been up and running with that version of Smalltalk for 6 years or something. And they had published several articles in Scientific American and other places where they showed screenshots of what the windowed environment looked like. And so this is probably had been seen by hundreds of thousands, if not a couple million readers of one journal or another. So it was not... It's not like one secret group showed something to one person who saw its genius and took it on. It's actually this, many people had seen it, but not everybody was Steve Jobs. Not everybody was able to sort of take this and run with it into a commercial product. So anyway, it's a very interesting answer he wrote up here. Worth reading if you're curious about this stuff.
Yeah, it is neat to hear, like, you know, hear it in a slightly different way from how you usually hear it.
Right. Here's some different angles on what happened. All right, Paul.
Yes.
You got something about BASIC.
Yes, so this is a recent post, actually by John Linville, who's, what is he, the Cocoa Crew podcast, is that the... But he wrote up a blog article basically about putting a Cocoa 3 program on a cartridge. So, and it's actually, it's sort of surprisingly... interesting. I mean, maybe not surprising, but what he was basically trying to do was deal with the fact that I think, as I understood it, the Cocoa 3, when it boots up, applies some basically patches to the BASIC that's in ROM already in order mm-hmm. to have the fancy stuff the Cocoa 3 has that the predecessors didn't, but I think it's sort of built to then forget it if you're trying to put in a cartridge and run something that would be compatible with the earlier Cocoa. And so what he's done is he's written something sort of like a bootloader on a cartridge, and you can sort of read through the details of it. This is actually a revision of even a prior one, but he's basically managed to get a cartridge to retain the Cocoa 3-ness of the Cocoa 3's ROM, and then, you know, run a program off of the cartridge. And it looks to me like it's essentially, you know, fiddling with a couple of soft switches and then stuffing the input buffer with something that will run the program. But it's a fairly clever little hack. So
cool. Yeah, I do like that ending there, which is sort of poking these characters into that input buffer to set up a thing. Yeah, it's kind of like if DOS never had this autoexec.bat sort of thing, but would only run some system program instead that would let you, in which you could have a binary that would pretend to type something.
Yeah. That was actually the Apple II, particularly the cassettes on the Apple II, tended to have a sort of similar kind of protection, which what you do is essentially to load a cassette, you say, like, start here and, you know, read this many bytes from the tape. Mm-hmm. But if you start below the place in the memory map where the keyboard buffer is, then it'll read, or at the point where the keyboard buffer is, it'll read into that keyboard buffer, and then it will automatically execute that because it thought you typed it.
Ah.
It's pretty cool. And actually also that it's not very far between the keyboard buffer and the screen space. So it also loads data onto the screen memory that can serve as a splash screen too. It's a kind of cool what you could do with the tapes.
Interesting. Cool. Yeah, this is a neat little hack way to get something working there. Earl, you were recently at the Vintage Computer Festival West, and I would love to hear about that. I know you were on a panel, and that's all I know, but I'd love to hear what else happened there.
Well, I was at the Vintage Computer Festival West in the San Francisco Bay Area, specifically in Mountain View at the Computer History Museum in California, and it was an awful lot of fun. Some of the highlights for me, well, first, just being at a VCF was awesome. Since I never had made it to one before, this was a great experience. Some of the highlights included seeing a device called the Monster 6502. We've talked about it before on the RCR. It's a transistor level reimplementation of the 6502 microprocessor, and fairly big and with lots of LEDs that actually show you what's going on when the processor is running programs. You've seen videos of it. It doesn't quite do it justice. You really got to see it in person. And I had a few minutes to talk with the creator, the Monster 6502, and it was fun hearing some of the story of how it came about. Anyway, that was cool to see. Another highlight was I met a gentleman named Mark, and I hope I'm pronouncing his last name somewhat right, Verdiel. He was part of the team at the Computer History Museum that restored a Xerox Alto recently. And there's a series of videos on YouTube documenting their story of going from an unworking Alto to a completely working Alto, awesome. And I saw the Alto that they restored. It was actually out on the floor. You could touch it and everything. And it was neat seeing that bit of history there and understanding what they had gone through to make that operable again. Some other things, I chatted with the folks who have been working on restoring a multiplayer online role-playing game called Habitat. It might be actually the first in what you would call that graphical multiplayer online role-playing game. It was a part of the Quantum Link dial-up service that was available for the Commodore 64, and that dial-up service eventually morphed into America Online. Habitat, and it's kind of, and I don't exactly understand the relationship here, but it is something's a subset of something. There was a piece of Quantum Link called Club Carib, and people loved that environment. You'd have your avatar, you could interact with other characters, it was graphical, it's a virtual world, 2D of course, but I mean, we're talking 80s and people just loved this. And when Quantum Link Reloaded happened a while back, they figured out how to recreate the back end of the Quantum Link service and let Commodore 64s connect to it again. People were really hoping this would be a part of that. Unfortunately, it wasn't. I think the code was lost or whatever, and these folks have been bringing it back. So I sat down with, talked with them about, you know, what's it like to try and reverse engineer the API that, because they don't have the original code. So what they had to do was write new code for the back end that would still create the experience that would allow you to connect to it from the Commodore 64 front end software and run around in this virtual world. As you can imagine, lots of technical challenges, but they did it. I saw it in operation. It was cool. And I went through an exhibit at the Computer History Museum called Revolution. I don't know. I almost feel like it's tongue-in-cheek when they call it the first 2,000 years of computing. But But it really is, in fact, I mean, stuff that goes back many, many years, mechanical calculators and that kind of thing, all the way up to modern day. They have neat artifacts in that exhibit. Very well done. I was very impressed with the placards that explain to you what's going on here and what part does this particular artifact play in history. Where did it come from? Who made it? Neat job. And I wish I had time to explore more of the Computer History Museum. I didn't, but that just leaves me more for next time. And the thing that you mentioned, Jack, I had the incredible honor of hosting a panel of some former Commodore engineers. They included Yash Terakura, who originally was with Commodore Japan, but came over to the States later on, did engineering with Commodore. He worked on the VIC-20, on the Commodore 64, and on a variety of other projects, was with Commodore way back in the calculator days. Another member of the panel was Leonard Trammell, one of the sons of Jack Trammell, and who also worked on a variety of things at Commodore during those days. One of the things I didn't know is that Leonard Trammell had done a lot of the Petsky character set that's so famous in the Commodore world, the set of glyphs that they have that you can use to do ASCII-like graphics. Another gentleman on the panel, Benny Pruden, was with Commodore's Advanced R&D division, and he joked that most of the things that he worked on never saw the light of day, because his boss would come to him and say, hey, work on this. They'd work on it, they'd get to prototype status, and then they'd kill it and go on to the next thing. And it was like, he made the joke that he's the kiss of death on a project. Some of the stuff that he talked about that was really interesting. And also on the panel was Bill Hurd. Bill is a very gregarious former Commodore engineer, did, you know, the main work on the Commodore 128, also had finished up the TED series of computers that we were talking about earlier, the Plus 4 and the C16, the 116, the 264, 364, that kind of thing. And that panel was really amazing. We went through a timeline of the Commodore 8-bit computers. The title of the panel was Commodore of the 8-bit Years. And so we had a big poster, everything starting from the PET 2001 down to the last of the 8-bits, the Commodore 128, and so on. And as we went through that timeline, we got to hear a lot of the stories of the engineering of those systems, you know, backstory. I think there was probably history that came out there in that panel that hadn't been heard anywhere before, either on YouTube or in the Brian Bagnell book or that kind of thing. So that was a lot of fun. We did have one panel attendee that wasn't able to be there. Chuck Peddle was not able to be there. There was some logistics issues that got in the way there. He was originally scheduled to be there, and that bummed me out a little bit because I was really looking forward to meeting him, the inventor of the 6502, he and his team, and of course the Commodore PET.
Right.
So would have been fun. But I had a great time hosting that panel, and the panel was just fabulous and very well received from the audience. We probably went on for 2 hours. I think we started at 3:30. We probably closed the place down at 5:30, and people still didn't want to leave. So
cool. Is this was this recorded? Is it going to be online?
I'm told that it was recorded. That there were actually dueling video cameras going on.
Okay.
And you know, I'm hoping it comes online as soon as possible because it was really fun. And that was my time at the VCF. I had a great time.
Awesome. It sounds like a lot of fun. I would love to see that panel when it comes up and to have seen some of the other stuff you saw. The Monster 6502 in person must be quite the sight.
That was neat. You know, LEDs are difficult to capture on video or photograph, and so actually seeing it in person was much better.
Cool. Awesome. Thank you for that report.
Yeah, you bet.
Let's move on. This is one thing that popped up a while ago. It's not particularly new, but We haven't talked about it. This is the 2017 version of the classic Amiga. This is a computer called the Aeon Amiga X5000. Yeah, this is an article from Ars Technica where they describe this machine. Basically, it's a computer you can buy, comes in a big tower box like any modern PC, but it's running a fast PowerPC chip of some kind. It's a dual-core free-scale CPU that can clock up to 2.5 gigahertz. And so what this let do is it let you run any of the Amiga software that's been written for PowerPC natively, and other software pops up in an emulator. So basically what they have is they have the latest version of Amiga OS, which is Amiga OS 4.1, and it's been all tweaked out to run on a nice, fast video card. I think they might have a few options, I'm not really sure. So if you ever ran an Amiga back in the day, you can fire this up and there you go. And you have a similar sort of workbench that existed before. It's a bit different now. It seems to have a dock kind of along the lines of Mac OS X. And obviously a lot of new things happened with the OS, but it looks like it's basically along the same lines of what the Amiga OS used to be. So there are a fair number of native applications. I mean, nothing compared to, you know, what's available for Mac or Windows today. But if you're a hobbyist, this could be a fun thing to have. Looks like it's quite expensive, and there's not a ton of new Amiga software being out in the world, but it should run all kind of existing Amiga software, including all the classical games, right out of the box in some sort of emulator. And yeah, actually, I think there are two things. I think if you're running games, the hardware is straight off. There is some kind of, it fires up an emulator. And if you're running more things that are old applications that are not PowerPC compiled, but are made for the old 68000 series CPUs, it has some sort of just-in-time compiler that kind of translates it into PowerPC code for you when you launch it. And they say it happens very quickly, so you don't even notice it.
Huh.
Interesting.
That's weird. That is weird.
I'm guaranteed to not buy one, but I like the idea. As an old Amiga fan, I think it's interesting. And I think it's cool that people keep up this kind of crazy old thing.
Yeah, I think if you're an Amiga diehard, then here's an Amiga that is modern, that you can buy today, and you can run things on. And I think it's a testament to how much people loved that platform that they're still keeping it alive, and there are still, like you say, Jack, there aren't many, but there are still titles that either come out or get updated for the Amiga OS. And you can do things like use a web browser and, you know, the things that you're used to doing with a modern computer are mostly there.
Yep.
Yeah, in the conclusions it says, it's like a window into an alternate universe where Commodore never went bankrupt and the Amiga platform never died. And it really seems like it is. I mean, like it's a new fast Amiga. It has this weird place that it's not, I mean, I guess it's kind of a retro computing thing, except that it's not really. I mean, like it emulates things just as much as other computers do, I guess. I wonder, so it seems like this transition is the same one that Apple made, right, between the 68K and the PowerPC, and I wonder if, and Apple did this a similar kind of thing for a while, I forget what it's called now, but when they ran, what was the name of that?
Rosetta.
There was some sort of, yes, Rosetta, yeah.
Yep.
I wonder if any of the technology, at least the ideas probably are similar in trying to run the 68K stuff on the PowerPC, the faster PowerPC, but...
Right.
Yeah. I too am pretty much guaranteed not to buy one, but it's interesting. It's very interesting.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, I think I'm very excited that this thing exists, and it's, you know, kind of sad personally that I know I'm not going to ever have one, but... Well, if maybe someone will send me a review unit. Hint, hint. I can do an in-depth review for the RCR. Right. You send me one of these things. Yeah, anyway, cool thing. I would like to try and play with one sometime. Someday. Paul, you have something else about another 80s kind of platform of sorts that has got some new life.
Yeah, so this recently been an announcement that there's a new addition to the Internet Archive for HyperCard stacks. So HyperCard, I personally did not have that much experience with HyperCard. A lot of people who did love it and were very sad when it kind of went away. But it's sort of like, I mean, I guess, you know, probably everybody sort of knows what it is, but I mean, it's sort of like web development on your local machine in a way. Right. Like you put little things that you can click on that go from card to card, and you can attach little scripts to the buttons. And so in fact, Myst, I believe the, you know, massively mm-hmm. popular game was a HyperCard game. You click on things and turn around and, you know, things happen. In the world, things change when you pull a lever and that kind of thing.
Right.
But so what's happened on the Internet Archive, a little while ago, they managed to get Macintosh emulation in the browser. So classic Mac, you know, OS 6 and 7, I think, you can just emulate in the browser. And so now they've added a sort of HyperCard level. So there's a list of HyperCard stacks where... And this is actually in celebration of the anniversary, I should say, the 30-year anniversary of HyperCard, August 11th, 1987. Bill Atkinson announced a new product. Mm-hmm. And so there are many things there. I've played around with it a little bit. You know, it's quite random, the set of things that there are. But you can sort of see what there are and what's there. And if you have your own stacks that you want to contribute, there's a place, hypercardonline.tk, that is collecting these. And yeah, anyway, you know, so I played around, I booted it up and looked at a little like Twin Peaks fac. That was about as far as I got, but have either of you played around with it at all?
I am at this moment launching a game that is called Buckwheat's Hairdo.
Yeah. Yeah, there's
which seemed like this seemed like if you're gonna have a HyperCard stack, this is the one you want to have. I think I expect to see a razor that will let me cut his hair. We'll see.
It's unsurprisingly there's a wide range of things available in the HyperCard archives here, and not all of them are of equal quality,
right?
Or equal appropriateness, yeah. Or whatever, but. Yeah. Have a look.
I'm having a look. I guess one thing that's interesting as I'm looking at this right now is that I'm struck by the fact that the emulator, like the emulator visibly boots up with the HyperCard system disk. And it seems like for this, since they have a specific thing where, okay, all of these types of things are going to launch into a thing where HyperCard is on one disk and other things on another disk, they could just have kind of like a save state where, you know, have the virtual machine save at the point where it has booted up and has that initial disk there. So you wouldn't even have to wait for it. That's my one critique.
Yeah. But
but that's fine.
It's pretty cool though. I mean, like, I guess in a sense that's less easy than just basically having the independent pieces of like, here are the disks, mount those, here's the emulator, go, you know. But it does seem like there's likely to be some way that you can just save RAM into some sort of a snapshot.
Yeah, I would think so.
It works pretty well.
I would not recommend Buckwheat's Hairdo, by the way.
Okay.
Actually, well, it depends. It's slightly fun. To play once. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, like you said, it's very... You scroll through here and it's just like, wow, this is so random. But, and I kind of remember playing with HyperCard in the early 90s, but I remember people were talking about it and talking about how you can make things with this, and all I could figure out how to do was like launch it and kind of draw stuff on the screen. Like how to actually make multiple pages and buttons linking them was totally, I just couldn't figure it out. Then again, I didn't have a Mac at the time. I remember I was doing this like in a lab somewhere, just kind of spending a few minutes now and then trying to make some sense out of it, and I never could. But clearly people could, and people did, and people, and I've heard people in the 30 years since always raving about HyperCard and the great things you could do with it. So I'm looking forward to poking around and trying out some more of this to see what people could do.
Well, I think one of the things that this allowed at the time that wasn't really available on the Mac, but had been really available on the sort of like prior platforms, was a kind of way, a simple programming environment. You know, like if you wanted to make a quick little thing, you can do it in HyperCard very easily, like you could have done in the BASIC and ROM or whatever in the previous computers.
Right. What was the programming language?
I don't know.
Okay.
HyperScript. HyperCard. I don't know.
Hard but, I mean, script.
But,
I don't know.
But I mean, there you definitely could attach little actions to the buttons to make them affect other things. So.
Yeah. All right. That's. I mean. Internet Archive does it again. One more great thing that they've put online for us to spend time messing around with. That's all the news you want to talk about. Most of it was not even new necessarily, but we talked about it anyway. Old news. Good. But let's look forward a bit. There are some shows coming up. We have a number of shows on our list here that are things we've talked about before. There's Oz KFest, there's VCF Midwest. The one new one that I'm adding is the Retro Gathering, which is a Swedish organization. They're having their annual fall event in Västerås, Sweden, on September 30th. And I was there last year. They seem to have a couple of events. It seems like the one in the fall is focused mostly on video games. And they had one that I think was back in February that I did not go to, that was more focused on old home computers. I missed that one. I'm probably going to go to this one, though, in the fall now. The theme of this is the Atari 2600, since it is the 40th anniversary of the release of that system. So I have plenty of experience and things to think about that, so I'm going to go there, see what I can see. And yeah, that's it. I think that's all the news we had for upcoming shows at all.
Yeah, I don't think there were any new things. Beyond that, there's Tandy Assembly and the Portland Retro Gaming Expo in October. And I think we mentioned that VCF Pacific Northwest was announced. So there are shows to go to.
Yep. We're going to get on to the rest of the show. First, a word from our sponsor.
Every day, Sun Microsystems touches the lives of hundreds of millions of people. Sun Systems serve as the backbone of the internet, connecting school children around the world, bringing internet commerce to the smaller shops in China, and providing the intranet solutions that are driving big business into the future. No matter where or how you're using the internet, you're using Sun. Since the network is the computer has to be Sun.
It's time to talk about the retro computing gift idea. And this is something that came up. This is an interesting thing that is not an actual computing device, but it is a replica of one. This is the Antikythera Mechanism Pendant. And what this is a device that they found one of these on a sunken ship. And it is believed to have been a device that was used to calculate astrological things, including perhaps eclipses. So I think the actual functioning of this thing has never been quite discovered yet, but it's a nice-looking thing that was found on a ship again, and someone has made a pendant of this. And so you can have this thing hanging around your neck. Costs 34 euros. It is bronze. This does not include a chain. What can you do? It's a polished bronze thing. A couple inches across.
So replica of a computer from what era?
From 100 BC. So it's a mechanical computer.
Clearly. So that is a retro computer.
This is as retro as it gets. This thing laughs at our giant 6502. It says, you want to see old? I'm old, buddy. And if you visit the website, which we will link to, they actually have a 3D model you can click and drag and rotate.
Ah, sounds cool. Like a neat conversation piece.
Yeah. Let's say, what is that on your neck?
I think at some point in the past we had links to, like, someone built one of these out of Lego, and like there've been a couple of replicas made. But if you wanted to actually predict when the next eclipse is yourself,
you could maybe build your own.
I predict it's tomorrow.
Well, okay.
I think you cheated.
Are you going to be there? We'll cool. Deal with that later.
All right. So that's the gift idea we have right now. That's it. We're sticking to it. All right. Let's move along to eBay auctions. I'm going to come up with an early spoiler here and say that I have nothing. So all I'll do is comment on you guys' stuff. Earl, you have something. Classic old Commodore.
Yeah. I was inspired by this trip to the VCF and talking about the old Commodore computers. So my eBay auction is a Commodore PET 2001 with the chiclet keyboard, mm-hmm. basically the first PET. And this particular auction shows one of these in what I think is really good cosmetic condition. Oftentimes mm-hmm. you see these are beat up. And if the case isn't beat up, at a minimum, the chiclet keyboard is kind of beat up. But on this one, I don't know what you guys think. It looked like it was in pretty good shape.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Now, you know, buyer beware, this computer works, but not quite. The amount of RAM that's showing when you start it up isn't quite enough. It should be a little bit more. I think the actual number should be 7,167 bytes free or something like that. And it's got 6,700, so something's gone haywire. And the RAMs for these old PET 2001s are not always easy to come by. So if it's a RAM chip out, you know, you might have a little bit of a time fixing it, but aside from that, I think this one was great.
So were these computers actually smart enough to know that if one RAM chip was not working, just to sort of discount it and not use it?
Yeah, they must be. Because, I mean, I know they had a startup check routine, and otherwise there's no way that you would see some other kind of number if it had been hard-coded.
Well, I guess the number that I was thinking of is that, like, could it be that there is a different ROM in it that includes like the included BASIC is a different size or something, because that BASIC consumes a certain amount of RAM, right?
Yeah, well, it's in a different section of RAM though. It's okay. It's in the upper banks on the 6502, and so no, I mean you're looking at a defect here of some sort.
Interesting. Okay, well, cool. It's in very good shape.
The keyboards. To the extent that I have seen these before, the keyboards usually... Are those stickers on the keys? Because they're usually in much worse shape. I mean, like, and these... So it looks like whatever happened to this machine in its past, survived. The keys survived much better than almost any other I've seen.
Yep.
You know, that's a good question about whether or not it's stickers on the tops of those. Because, like you say, I've seen them pretty beat up, but... I don't actually know the answer to that, which is weird because I used this particular model of PET quite a bit back in high school. Interesting. I have to look into that.
I suppose if it's stickers, then it might be sort of replaceable if they're beat up.
What do you think about the price of this, Earl? Right now it's, what, $285 is the current bid.
That's not terrible for this particular model. It's among the more... unobtainium of what I would say are pedestrian Commodore computers. I mean, things like the prototype Commodore 65s and that will go up in the thousands, but in terms of the more commonly available units, this is a little bit harder to come by.
Yeah.
Well, this is the only one I think that has the data set built in, right?
That's right.
I'd love to have one. I suspect I never will, but I have, what is it? Always forget CBM 8032, which is I'm happy enough with, but that's enough PET space.
Cool. Yeah, I have no Commodore PET in my life, and I never have, sadly. But this one, yeah, as far as these things go, this one looks pretty great. So cool. All right, Paul, what do you got for us?
Okay, I have many things. Given how late it is, it's possible that I will not talk about all of them, but who knows? I always say that, and then I talk about them anyway. I had also put a pet in my list. This is a super pet, which is, I guess, pretty much on the other end of the pets. I forget now what the deal was with it. It has 80 columns, much bigger screen, and I thought it had like a Z80 in it or something. Earl, you know something about this, don't you?
I thought it was a 6809. There's a couple processors in here, and one of the processors was for the Waterloo language system that the University of Waterloo had worked with Commodore to create a computer that could accommodate compilers for a variety of things like Fortran and COBOL. The idea was to have these be in distributed computing. The students could work on their programs on the computer and then up them to the mainframe when they were done, at where they could work on the real big iron. So, there's a couple switches in the back that will let you either switch between the processors, or also, once you had loaded in the part of the operating system, you could flip the read-only switch and lock that part in so it couldn't be changed, and then just work with your user programs without fear that you were going to clobber the other stuff that had been loaded into memory. They're pretty interesting systems. I actually have seen one in person at the local Commodore users group. A friend Greg has one, but I don't think he's ever lit up any of the Waterloo software, so I don't know if we know even if the second processor works on his.
Cool.
Oh, I see. But in this auction, they do definitely have a screenshot of, you know, Waterloo Microsystems Select, you know, some things. So it apparently runs on it.
There's also a photo of some three-way toggle switches. One is for PROG 6502, 6809, and one is for PROG read-write and read. So yeah. It's just that you're saying you can lock it down to do certain things and not do other things.
Right.
Cool.
Yeah. Another thing that would be kind of cool to get, this is a starting bid of $1,000 and $1,500 buy it now, so it's they know what it is.
Do you know when these were made, Earl?
Oh, I don't remember exactly when. No.
But is this all sort of still pre Commodore 64 era, or is this sort of overlapping that?
I think that might have been overlapping.
Yeah,
actually,
that's what I would have guessed. It wasn't. I thought there was a pet shaped model that had a C64 in it.
There was the educator
or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So they must have had some overlap. I guess maybe they had some spare cases.
I think, well, I'd be speculating on that. It, for some reason, it strikes me like they wanted those to be able to go into the schools and be an all-in-one unit that would be appropriate for an educational setting. And the PET cases were, you know, they were kind of bulletproof. So,
and they don't look like a game machine.
Right, and these
serious business.
And these had a green screen, even though it was a Commodore 64 that was driving them. So,
right.
Yeah, you little youngins, you know, better not be playing any games on these. Smack with a ruler.
Those were the days.
I was looking to see if I could find, you know, why don't you guys talk among yourselves, and I'll see if I can find the year that these things came out, the Super Pets.
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
While my cat snores here, I don't know if you can hear it. A cat's laying next to me and snoring, so that's just more audio work for you, Paul. Sorry about
Excellent.
That.
Fantastic.
Just additional texture.
Yes.
That's right.
Okay, well, I'll move on to the next thing while we're finding out the year details on the Super Pet.
All right.
The next thing is actually something I had never come across before, myself anyway, but it's a Heathkit ET6800. And so I would regularly bring up the ET3400 sort of like trainer things for the, I think it's the 6800 processor. What the ET6800 is a much scaled back version of the same thing. It is a keypad and a, you know, a little 7-segment display thing that's in a cardboard box. So it is a kit, I think, or at least it originally was a kit that you would build, soldered together with your Heathkit parts. But the ultimate form of it is in a cardboard box, which looks kind of hilarious.
Wow.
Cool.
Reduce, reuse, recycle.
Yeah. It seems to me like apart from the fact that it's, you know, that it is in a sort of like cheaper case, it is roughly the same thing as the ET3400 was. It has a full keypad, and I think you can program it to do the same kind of stuff. It doesn't have as much of a kind of like a breadboard area and that kind of thing. But, anyway, I thought it was interesting, something I hadn't seen before.
Cool. I'm looking at some of the attached paperwork, and there is this thing, the microprocessor's flip chart. I really want to know what's inside that flip chart. There's somehow very compelling about that. What is inside it? One picture shows directions of how you can sort of open up the flap behind it to make it stand up, which is very exciting. I guess it's, I don't know if it's opcodes for the CPU for doing assembly language programming or what it is. I don't know.
Probably. Heathkit had a number of courses that these things were used in, and certainly for the 3400, but, you know, presumably also for this 6800, which is twice a 3400. I think you can get, there's a Yahoo group that for the ET3400 that has a bunch of stuff uploaded to it, you know, that kind of educational material uploaded to it for the 3400. Might well be on the Internet Archive as well, but so you could probably, there's probably a way in to figure out what's in there.
Findable.
I know I have a couple of binders that I've never really opened, you know, like, but they are, there's, you know, microprocessor courses. If you want to learn. I mean, that's the point of these, I guess, is really learning how to do assembly programming or machine language programming.
Right. Cool. Nice.
The next thing I wanted to mention is there is a vintage microwave kit. Another thing I hadn't seen before, that I looked into it a little bit. This is basically somebody built a kit. Maybe it's possible that some of this stuff actually came with the kit. I'm not sure about that. But it's essentially like a ZX80 clone. And you could buy the kits that would, you know, lead you to a device that is just like a ZX80, you know, except not Timex Sinclair. And this is actually built into a box. It is a total disaster. I mean, it's just like wires running everywhere with little tape, you know, labeled 1, 3, 7 and stuff like that. And, you know, I think you would have to basically work out how the kit was built from the beginning in order to troubleshoot any bit of this.
Right.
But it looks kind of cool.
Yeah.
It's pretty crazy. Pretty expensive. We can say this in unison. they want $95 for it, but as a starting bid, in fact.
Yeah.
But
yeah, maybe for somebody, you know, for some enthusiast who's like, oh, you know, this might remind somebody of something. Oh, I remember that we had, you know, we built something as crazy as that.
Well, in fact, actually, there's someone named Steve, whose last name I am not completely sure about, but goes by Code Troll, wrote a blog post about building one of these called My First Computer, and it's not exactly the same as the one that in the eBay listing, but it's kind of the same idea. There's a some sort of chassis that it gets mounted in, and a keyboard, an external keyboard built for it, and so you can see one of these. You know, someone's recollection of one of these actual things.
Okay. What else you got?
Well, I have... I forget if I've talked about one of these before, but someone has listed an Apple Interactive Television box, so I thought I would put a link to it. This is they're asking for a $500 buy it now, which seems like it might be a bit high. These are weird little things. They're common for a rare item. they're often considered to be prototypes. I think they sort of are, I guess, but they made a lot of them. It's basically a cable box run with a Mac inside. So I don't remember what the current state of this is. I mean, it's essentially just one of the, I don't even know kind of what model it is inside, but it's like a pizza box, Mac. And, for a long time, no one could get them to do anything. I mean, you could see, look inside and you could see it's Macintosh components. There are places you can plug in ADB keyboards and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But no one could get any video out of it. And they also have a slot for ROMs. It needs the particular ROM in order to do anything. Part of the problem was that it's designed to be on a network. I think maybe even fetching some stuff like software off the network. But the network doesn't exist, of course.
Right.
So that's a problem. I'm pretty sure that within the last few years, somebody actually did manage to find video drivers or something, extensions that you could put in. So if you could if you could get a hard drive in it, mount it, put the appropriate system enablers in there, you can manage to get something on the screen. I have not tried this.
No.
I have one, which I think it's possible that the power supply doesn't work because it really is just like plugging in a rock, but, I've been meaning to try that out to see if I can get something out of it. But, anyway, it's kind of a neat thing. There's not very much you can do with it. And so I hesitate to suggest, paying $500 for it, but they're not super common either. It's just a weird thing, basically.
Yeah.
Where do we know when the Super Pet was, Earl?
1981.
Oh, okay. It's earlier than I thought. Interesting. I'll say the last thing I had. I found this sort of specifically after we were talking about the listener feedback. There's a Palm 3XE and GoType keyboard bundle that you can get for $45. Buy it now. Comes with the box. It plugs into that special adapter. So these things look very funny because it's like this huge keyboard and then this like little thing that sticks out of it. Palm actually sold a keyboard that folded up. So when it was folded in, I think, four pieces, it was the same size as the Palm. And then you unfolded it and it became, wide. It's kind of a neat set just because it has everything. Not super rare. I think I have all of these things actually somewhere. But I used to use the 3XE was my first Palm, and I was very pleased with it. That's it. I'll stop there.
Yeah, it's actually a very cheap price, I think, for this. $45 bucks for the Palm and the keyboard. And a little case.
And I think this took, if I'm not mistaken, this took regular batteries. So as long as they weren't left in there,
right,
then this should be still usable.
Yeah. Nice. Well, I think that's all the eBay that we have seen fit to expose to the world today. So, it's time to start wrapping things up. Paul, you had something you wanted to mention here, a thing or two.
Oh, yeah. Well, right. I put this thing in. It's actually more of a news item than a thing. But I don't know. I mean, as far as closing things up, I'm an academic, and so things are about to start again with the academic year. And so don't know exactly how much time I'm going to have to do things. Although I have to clear off enough space for people to come to meetings in this crazy mess of an office I have. But one of the news item thing that I put a link in there was that somebody did a pretty cool thing with a 2E card that goes into Macintosh, a certain set of Macintosh computers, including the Mac LC, which is basically it was an attempt by Apple to kind of bridge between the education dominance of the Apple IIe, and then they wanted to sell Macs to all the schools, and so you could get this card that was basically a IIe on a card.
Right.
So it would make the IIe basically, it would use the Mac screen and keyboard and stuff, but it was really, you know, some form of 6502 on there.
Mm-hmm.
And someone pointed to a pretty cool thing where they have a IIe card in an LC, and they figured out how the software, the Mac side software, works to kind of change the cards that are built into this IIe on a card, and it's pretty cool. So he's changed from kind of like the standard RAM card to a particular brand RAM factor emulator.
Mm-hmm.
But it's weirdly intriguing that you could start configuring at a deep level, like make up cards for this what is an actual 2E basically sitting in this Mac. So anyway, I thought it was cool. It didn't fit in any of the news spots, so I put it in my clothing notes spot.
Cool.
But the other thing, news-like thing, is that Halt and Catch Fire is about to start again. So.
Okay. I'm not at all caught up. I think I only watched one episode so far.
Uh-huh.
I'm way, way behind.
It kind of changes in feel from season to season. So,
okay.
But it's still kind of fun to see all the old computers around.
Right. All right. Cool. Earl, any other closing notes for you?
I'm going to see the eclipse tomorrow.
Ooh.
The what's called the path of totality, or the mm-hmm. strip of area across the United States where you get to see a total eclipse, is actually just not too far to the south of me. So we got tickets for a museum.
Mm-hmm.
It's called the Evergreen Aviation Museum. It has the Spruce Goose and some other neat aviation artifacts you can go see there. So they are in the zone that will be completely darked. So we're going to go tomorrow, get out of the house bright and early at 6 a.m. and drive there and go watch it. And it should be fun.
Nice.
And we got the glasses that... you know, there's a whole lot of hubbub in the last week about which glasses are the right glasses. And mm-hmm. Will these really protect your eyes? And, you know, it turns out that there is, I don't know, maybe a dozen manufacturers that got the seal of approval from the, what is it, the American Astronomical Society or whatever, the AAS.
Mm-hmm.
So I can talk about this because by the time the show airs, the eclipse will be over, so we have no fear of liability.
Right.
So, we made sure that the glasses that we got were certified on this particular list, and it is creepy. If you look at the sun, first off, you put these on, it's just dark. Completely, you can't see anything. But then you look at the sun, and you can see just this circle of light that is mm-hmm. the sun and nothing else. And so, you know, really neat. And they're the ISO certified and yada, yada, yada. So it should be a fun time, kind of a party atmosphere too, because a lot of people will be at this event that we're going to. So they're going to have, you know, big screen TV kind of showing the, you know, what's going on. So yay, I'll let you guys know how it goes.
Cool. What time is the totality where you are then?
Is it like 10 a.m. or something?
Okay.
Let me see. Oregon totality time.
I think here it's somewhere like 2:30. And it's not totality, but it's like 63% for Boston.
Just checking. They say here around where we're going to be, totality around 10:15 to 10 a.m. or 10:18 a.m.
Ah, nice.
Pacific time.
Cool.
When it apparently will just be as if it is suddenly night.
Yeah, they
which
say
makes total sense, but
they say the animals kind of get creeped out, and that you know, if people are interested in this, there's a whole science behind this eclipse thing. Total eclipses can have this rare phenomenon I don't remember exactly what it's called, but if you look at the ground just before and just after totality, you'll see these cyclical, almost sinusoidal waves on the ground that look like a group of snakes either approaching you or retreating from you. And they don't exactly know what even causes this. And this one eclipse enthusiast was talking about this, and he actually saw them once. He got on a ship or whatever. You know, he was this guy's nuts for eclipses. So, mm-hmm. I'm crossing my fingers. We'll see those tomorrow.
Wow,
yeah. Very cool. Yeah, I was very slow on getting to the glasses, and so everybody in Boston has sold out. So I'm just gonna MIT has a little viewing party of sorts that they invite the public to, and I think I might stop by there and use one of the shared glasses briefly.
I know I've seen the claim that you can use a CD or a DVD. That material doesn't a good enough job of just like if you hold that up to your eye and look at the sun, that will do kind of what you're saying, Earl. You normally can't see through a DVD or a CD quite, but it blocks enough to where you can see the light of the sun coming through, and therefore you can see the shape of the sun. I don't know if that's safe for your eyes, but
yeah. Interesting.
It all seems very frightening, the possibility that you could like see the eclipse and then not see anything else for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
Which is why we went with the safe bet.
Yeah. All right. Well, I get to see no eclipse tomorrow here in Sweden. We have none of that. But be careful out there in eclipse land, you guys.
Okay.
And
we'll keep an eye on things.
All right. On that note, let's wrap this up. You can find show notes for this and all episodes of the RCR at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss this episode and other episodes in the forums at www.vcfed.org/forum/forum.php. This is the Vintage Computer Federation. Please follow RCR on Twitter at rcrpodcast, and please join our Facebook group, which you can find by searching for RCR Podcast. And we'd love to hear your feedback about what you think about the show, any news items you want us to talk about, any thoughts you have about anything, questions. Email us at feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We are a proud member of the Throwback Network. You can find many other podcasts with people talking about old stuff at throwbacknetwork.net. And as always, please go into iTunes and write a review and give us a 5-star rating. Or less if you're going to be a huge jerk about it, but preferably 5 stars. That is the preferred number of stars at all times. So, until next time, Retro Compute!